Voilà, nous allons avoir le plaisir d'entendre Neil Jacobs, qui est le directeur des supports de communication de JISC, Joint Information Systems Committee, qui est un comité important au Royaume-Uni. Neil va nous expliquer, il va s'adresser à nous en anglais, mais il va vous expliquer les tenants et aboutissants des efforts de JISC.
I'm sorry, but I must speak in English. I apologize. And thank you for listening to me. So the challenges of open access in the UK. So this is what I'm going to say this afternoon. How did the UK get here? Why did the UK get here? Something about where here is. What are the current state of UK policies? What are the challenges and what next? So how did the UK get to where we are now? It sometimes seems that open access started in 2012 with the Finch report, but that isn't true. There was a lot of work going on before 2012. There was incremental growth in repositories, a range of reports. The research funders, the research councils in the UK had policies. The Wellcome Trust had policy on open access and had set up UK PubMed Central, now Europe PubMed Central, of course. But it all did come together in 2012 with the Finch report. And UK government support for open access, which resulted in revised policies by the research councils in favour of gold open access. Again, 2012, very relevant to the UK and to all of us, the European Commission recommendations to member states. 2014, the funding councils in the UK, so that's the other side of the UK funding system, adopted their own open access policy. And that was updated last year. So that's how we got here. Those were the main steps that the UK took. Why did we get here? Well, it was a balancing act. There were a lot of pressures from all sorts of different stakeholders. And these are some of the factors that had to be kept in mind. And I'll just quickly run through these because it's interesting how they play out in the UK. So academic freedom. In this context, academic freedom is usually taken to mean the author having complete freedom to choose where they publish. It's less commonly understood as the author having complete freedom to read articles from wherever she wishes to do so. But that's another part of academic freedom. Value for money, especially in this case, the cost-effective use of public money in support of research, including the communication of that research, is a major, major and increasing factor in the UK. Administrative simplicity. So some of the arrangements for open access imply some really quite serious administration by authors, by universities, funders, readers and publishers. Some of those administrative tasks are part of a transition to open access, and some of them may well be a permanent change. A competitive market is something that rings very strong in the UK. Since money changes hands, then the arrangements around academic journals sometimes described as a market. If it is a market, then it should work well as a market, including effective competition. There are some who argue that there's very little sensitivity to price in this market, and that makes it a rather unusual market. Productivity and growth, this was one of the major drivers behind the UK government's support for open access. The potential improvement in knowledge transfer, we've heard about already, from public research to commercial innovation, leading to improvements in economic performance, productivity, growth, employment, and so on. The publishing industry is strong in the UK. It's a significant export earner for the UK economy, and it employs many people in the UK. That's an important factor in why the UK ended up where it did. Learned societies are also publishers quite often and undertake a lot of valuable work, as they do in France and elsewhere, in supporting the research community, especially early career researchers and contributing to the public understanding of science. Much of this is funded through the surpluses they make through journal publication. Assumptions about the rest of the world. So the Finch Report made a number of assumptions about what would happen in the rest of the world in the period following 2012. Not all of those are really standing up very well. They may well be worth revisiting. I can go into more detail on that if you like. And dual funding for universities. So in the UK, there are two main ways in which universities get funded, through grants for research, through grants for projects in the future, and through grants to universities looking back at their research performance over the last few years. And the policies, the open access policies that are appropriate in those two cases are not necessarily the same. So the UK position was arrived at considering all of these factors and others in something of a balancing act, which has led to what some people described as a fragile consensus in the UK. These are the policies in the UK at the moment, or at least relevant to the UK. Broadly speaking, the research, this is very complicated, it's deliberately complicated because it is complicated. For any particular research paper authored by a particular academic, it's pretty complicated. They may be funded by more than one funder. They certainly want to submit to the research excellence, the research assessment exercise. They may be working on a Horizon 2020 project, all of which have their own policies. I've detailed here the ones for journal articles and also for monographs. Monographs haven't had much of a mention today, but I think they're incredibly important in many, many disciplines. Few open access policies with respect to monographs so far, but there are some. So the main point here is this is a very complicated picture. What are the main challenges? So this is what I was really asked to focus on today, so I will spend a short amount of time going through this slide. And I've grouped these challenges into three: achieving compliance, constraining costs, and realizing the benefits. So achieving compliance, firstly, you've seen the very complicated policy environment in the UK, and we're dealing with the current situation as best we can by providing accurate information to researchers about what their obligations are, what they have to do if they're funded by a particular funder, if they're working at a particular university and want to publish in a particular journal. So many of you will know we have services such as Sherpa, Romeo, that help us to do that. But we're also trying to improve the situation in two ways. So one is to improve the clarity. Many of these policies, certainly journal policies, are not necessarily very clear. And sometimes funder and institutional policies can be a little unclear, a little ambiguous as to what authors are allowed to do. So we're working with journal publishers and with funders and with institutions to try and develop a more structured language for expressing these policies so that systems and services can express those in clear ways so that academics know what they do, not what they need to do. But we're also hoping and working with others in the UK to try and simplify that policy environment from the top down. It's worth noting that, you know, achieving compliance in that environment is difficult. A recent report said that over 60% of UK research outputs are still not open access, not openly available in any form. And that's 3-4 years after the Finch report. And even those that are usually, well, quite often, don't comply with the funder policy. So we have an awfully long way to go to achieve compliance. Constraining costs. This is perhaps what I should spend most time looking at, as it's come up already. So there are clearly several kinds of costs. The additional costs of paying article publication charges to journals on top of subscriptions. So our expenditure on APCs in the UK went up 2.7 times between 2013 and 2014. And we estimate between 14 and 15, our expenditure on APCs has gone up by about another 50%. So it's rising really quite fast, roughly about £10 million per year. and rising very rapidly. So clearly the sorts of deals that we've been doing with Wiley and Taylor and Francis and Springer and the Institute of Physics Publishing and most recently with Springer are important in offsetting the payments, the APCs, against the subscriptions. And they do that in various ways. We've been very open to all kinds of different models that publishers would like to propose for addressing this issue. And as a result, we've learned quite a lot about what works and what doesn't work for universities. And we've developed a set of principles that summarize our lessons so far. We released those earlier this year. And they broadly are that an offsetting scheme needs to support the transition to fully open access, full gold open access. The hybrid environment is not sustainable for anyone. It's a transition mechanism and it needs to be seen to be so. The second principle is that the universities don't get charged twice. The third is that those schemes shouldn't be limited to participants in the big deals. So many universities in the UK don't participate in big deals, many do. But these schemes should apply to all of those universities, and they should apply at the local level. Clearly, if the UK, as it has, taken a lead in gold open access, we're going to be paying quite a lot more, and our universities are going to be paying quite a lot more, and therefore global discounts don't really benefit UK universities as much as we think they should. And finally, these schemes need to be based on cash rather than vouchers. Vouchers are administratively difficult to manage. So those are the sorts of principles that we came up with as a result of doing all these deals over the last year or two. We're monitoring how these deals are going, both in terms of the cash savings they make for universities and the administrative pain that they cause for everybody concerned. And we will adjust our negotiations according to that, you know, the picture that arises. It's early days. It's early days so far. So that's the total expenditure, and I have touched quite a lot about administrative costs as well. I'll say a little bit more about those as they relate to compliance, so for reporting to funders. So universities are having to collect a lot of data now to report to funders about how well they've complied with those mandates. And we've come up with two sets of lists, if you like, two sets of requests or practical steps that universities can take and that publishers can take to really help that administrative burden. So universities can, for example, implement ORCID. I assume everyone here is familiar with ORCID, can develop an open access policy and communicate that with researchers, can use existing services such as the Sherpa services and implement standard metadata and so on. So universities can take those sorts of steps and publishers can take some steps as well. So we figure that we're paying quite a lot to publishers and that they ought to be able to offer a decent level of service in return. Many of them do, of course, but we're asking for things like publishers notify universities when a journal article has been accepted, because that's now a key point in the article life cycle that universities need to know about, that they implement ORCID and use Crossref, their shared service, fully, and they are clear about the licenses and permissions. They may not be the licenses and permissions that we want them to give us, but at least we would like them to be clear about what those are. We're then in a much better position to negotiate on them. Finally, in terms of challenges, realizing the benefits, and that's in terms of making the research visible and usable. Again, we're talking about text and data mining here. Pushing this open access content into innovation portals, learning what it is that that commercial companies need from this material, making it available in ways that would be useful to them, and tracking use and impact. So we have services in the UK that do that, and they recorded around 20 million downloads from UK repositories last year. So clearly the stuff in repositories, albeit earlier versions of research articles, is of value to quite a lot of people. And we know there's a lot of work going on in that sort of area. So quickly onto what next, just to finish off. There are two reviews underway in the UK at the moment. One is a spending review by the government. It's a comprehensive spending review looking at all public spending in the UK. We expect announcements towards the end of November. We don't expect there to be a huge amount more money available. In fact, we expect there to be somewhat less money available than there is at the moment, and that may well have consequences for open access. And the second is a policy review. So the government department has asked a senior academic to review the open access policy as it currently exists and see whether or not some changes might be needed in some small, perhaps, ways. And that we expect to advise government sometime in the next few months. So as a result of that, I would be not surprised if there were some small changes as a result of these reviews. It would be pointless setting up reviews if there were not some idea that things might change sometime next year. So thank you very much for listening. That's a very quick canter through the situation in the UK.
Thank you very much, Neil.